The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Good evening. My name is Morris Williams, and it is my privilege to welcome you to another outstanding author event at the Free Library of Philadelphia. The Free Library of Philadelphia is important in Philadelphia because everyone is welcome and everything is free. In this environment of COVID and virtual education, I do want to encourage you to continue to and expand your support of the Free Library because of all of the after-school events and the summer programs that are so important in helping our children to deal with the risk of lost opportunities for education as a result of COVID. We must do everything to support our children, and the Free Library is a wonderful way to do it. This evening, we are so thrilled to have the sixth appearance of Walter Isaacson here in the Free Library author series. You have received information about him, which I will not repeat. I will simply alert you to the fact that the title of the seminar that he is teaching at Tulane this semester is The History of the Digital Revolution, which is a seminar filled with discussion about technology, culture, and the progression of society. I would that we all would have that opportunity that those students in Tulane are so fortunate to receive. The other thing I will simply share with you is my hope that at some point, Walter writes an autobiography of his own life, because his written record encompasses such a range of people, from Da Vinci to Kissinger to Jennifer Doudna. But his record in terms of the things that he does, whether it's the Aspen Institute, whether it's serving on the board of United Airlines, whether it's teaching at Tulane, his history and journalism, he's got a wonderful story to tell. And my guess is he'll be able to tell it in a way that will help to bring the left and the right together in terms of building bridges to help make America a more successful nation. We are delighted tonight to have Philadelphia's award-winning broadcaster and journalist, Tracy Maddox, to interview Walter. And so without further ado, I'll turn it over to Tracy and Walter and say again, Walter, thank you so much. And Tracy, thank you so much for your support of the Free Library of Philadelphia.
Thank you.
Well, thank you so much, Morris. I'm Tracy Matisak. I am absolutely delighted to be here tonight with Walter Isaacson. And of course, we are discussing his new book, Codebreaker. It is a fascinating read if you haven't had the opportunity to read it already. But we will, as we always do, budget some time for your questions toward the end of the program. So do be jotting down any questions that you might have for Walter Isaacson as we go through our conversation, and we will fit as many of those questions in as possible before the end of the program. That said, Walter Isaacson, welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia.
It's great to be back, Tracy, or virtually back.
Well, you are a regular indeed, and we're thrilled to have you as we always are. I want to start from the beginning and talking about The Codebreaker. The book is about Jennifer Doudna. Who is Jennifer Doudna, and why did you choose her as the subject of your most recent book?
Jennifer Doudna is an absolutely fascinating scientist, relatively unknown, but then she won the Nobel Prize last October. So that helped the book and helped propel it along. but she was somebody who grew up in Hawaii with that curiosity that all the characters I write about have. She read The Double Helix by James Watson and sort of noticed Rosalind Franklin as a character, the woman who did the imaging that helped figure out the structure of DNA. And so she told her school counselor she wanted to be a scientist. And the counselor said, no, girls don't do science. But she persisted and she did. And she became a great chemist and biologist. And eventually, when all the other men in the world of biology seemed to be focusing on DNA during the Human Genome Project and figuring out how to sequence our human DNA, she and Jillian Banfield and Emmanuel Charpentier, some of the women who are the main characters in my book, focused on RNA, which is a less celebrated sibling of DNA. But it's a molecule that actually does work. Jennifer discovered how RNA is the molecule that began life on this planet. Her advisor said, look for the big questions. She said, what are the big questions? He said, how did life begin? Well, it begins with RNA being able to replicate itself. Then she discovers with Emmanuel Charpentier, her research partner, how to use this molecule as a guide to make an enzyme edit our own genes so we can change our DNA. And of course, RNA is in the is the messenger molecule telling our cells what proteins to build in the Pfizer and the Moderna coronavirus vaccines we've all gotten. And now she turned her attention to using all these technologies to fight the next waves of viruses, but also to deal with the moral and ethical issues. Like, when should we edit our genes? When should we design our children to have certain traits we want? And so she became a great narrative figure I could walk hand in hand with on this journey of discovery. And even though there are about 10 or so other colorful characters, she's the main character in the book.
Yeah. You mentioned RNA, and of course, as you said, DNA is sort of the one that gets all the attention, but we've been hearing more about RNA, as you said, because of two of the new vaccines that are mRNA vaccines. Can you explain a little bit more about how they work?
Yeah, messenger RNA is the most basic job that RNA does on this planet. And it means simply that DNA sits there in the nucleus of our cells, curating our genetic information. It has, you know, our DNA has our genes in it, but the DNA doesn't do anything. It just sits there in the nucleus of the cell. So RNA goes and takes little snippets of our genes and goes and builds proteins in our cells. Well, you can repurpose that system and you can tell the RNA, build this spike protein. That's the same spike protein that's on a coronavirus. And that's what the vaccine does. It tells our cells to make a bit of that spike protein. And that means our immune system has a reaction to that spike protein. So the time, anytime the real coronavirus hits us, boom, it knows how to kill it. And so that's a very simple new way, and we've never done that before. The good thing about that technology is if the coronavirus mutates and we have a variant like we're seeing now, you can just reprogram the messenger RNA and say, okay, the spike protein's a little different this month. Here's how it's shaped. And you can make vaccines for new variants. You can make vaccines for bacteria infections. You can even make vaccines sometime soon for cancer.
Wow. So that brings to mind the fact that we've been hearing in the news frequently of late about these variants. And there has been some concern about resistance to the vaccine. Are you concerned about that? Or do you feel that we have enough information now to be able to modify the vaccines to kind of meet whatever challenge these mutations might bring?
It took the scientists in my book about one weekend, as soon as they had the sequence of the original coronavirus, to program the molecule, as if it were a microchip, to program it to make the mRNA vaccines. Now, we had to go through months of testing and clinical trials and figure out how to make those little particles that delivered into our system. But all that's been done now, and we won't have to do new clinical trials if we sort of revise or re-engineer the mRNA to fight a new variant. So I'm not really worried. I think that the current vaccines are very effective even against the variants. I think that especially they'll keep the variants from causing great sickness. And if we get variants that are much more dangerous, we'll have booster shots. Now, it does mean, you know, that's a bit of a struggle, getting our shots, now getting booster shots, but this time it'll be much faster.
You mentioned cancer vaccines, which is fascinating. I mean, is there any sense of when we might see something like that?
We're already doing immunotherapy, which is the way you use our immune system to fight particular cancers. And there are a couple things that the new technologies that Jennifer Doudna and her colleagues have done that will help on that. First of all, cancer is a very clever, you know, dangerous, cells, and they're able to turn off our immune system sometimes, you know, using just a little genetic thing to turn it off. Well, with CRISPR, we can edit it so the immunotherapy can't be defeated that easily by the cancer. But we also can use the mRNA functions of RNA, in other words, the messenger function, to have it build certain proteins or build things in our own cells that will help either fight the cancers or create immunotherapies that would fight the cancers. In China, that's already being done. China's ahead of it. But the good thing is right there in Philadelphia, the University of Pennsylvania is the lead at the moment in using CRISPR and having clinical trials already using CRISPR for cancer treatments. So you should be proud. I mean, Philadelphia has always been in the lead for 250 years. But when it comes to using CRISPR technology for cancer, it's China and Philadelphia, the two places doing it fastest.
I want to drill down on CRISPR in just a moment, but it struck me as I was reading your book, you said that at some point you were struck by the notion that biology is the new tech. You said that we're transitioning from the digital revolution to the life sciences revolution. And I wonder how you think they compare in significance.
Well, you know, at Harvard one year, Mark Zuckerberg and Fong Zhang were in the same class. We all know who Mark Zuckerberg is. Fong Zhang was the person who first showed in a published paper how CRISPR could be used to edit human genes. I think 50 years from now, we'll all know who Fong Zhang is. And that technology that Jennifer Doudna, George Church, Fong Zhang all did in this competitive race I describe in my book, that technology will be so much more important than Facebook and Twitter ever were. I think the life sciences revolution will be hugely more significant. Yes, the digital revolution has given us great communication tools and ways to disseminate information, but this will give us the tools to edit our own genes, design our own babies, fight hereditary diseases, fight cancer. And in the next 50, you know, we've had 50 years of the digital revolution. It pretty much, you know, began in the very early 1970s when the computer, the microchip, and the internet all sort of combined. Well, 50 years from now, I think that the life sciences revolution will be a lot more consequential.
I want to take a moment and remind our audience that you, if you have questions for Walter Isaacson, you should see a little Q&A icon at the bottom of your screen. You can click on that and you can enter your question there. And again, we'll get through as many as we can. Walter, you've been talking about CRISPR, and I think this is the perfect time to do a little deeper dive and help us understand exactly what CRISPR is and what its applications are.
Well, it's a very simple thing because bacteria have been doing it for a billion years, and they're not much smarter than we are. What happens whenever bacteria get attacked by a virus, and by the way, viruses attack bacteria just like they attack us. The bacteria takes a mugshot of that virus, a tiny snippet of its genetic material, and it puts it in clustered repeated sequences in the bacteria's own genetic code. And that's why they're called CRISPRs. So if the virus comes back, the bacteria can recognize it, and it takes RNA and targets that invading virus and chops it up with the scissors. What Jennifer Doudna discovered, along with Emmanuel Charpentier, and what got him the Nobel Prize, was we can repurpose that system. We can re-engineer it. We can reprogram that guide RNA to snap up one of our own sequences, to cut our own DNA. So all it is a simple scissors with a guide that you can program that says, cut the human DNA right here at this gene, at this place. And it's adapted from what bacteria do.
So as simple as the tool may sound, it certainly raises a host of very complicated ethical questions. Because on the one hand, you have, as you said, gene editing that helps to cure diseases. But on the other end, you've got gene editing that can be used in all kinds of ways where we can, to your point, begin to maybe design our children. And that's where it gets a little bit fuzzy. Talk about the ethical dilemmas that CRISPR presents.
Right after Jennifer Doudna invented ways to use this technology, she had a nightmare. And it was that somebody wanted to learn this technology. And she goes in the room and the person looks up and it's Hitler. So she recoils. And then over the next few months, she starts gathering scientists from around the world, from China, from Europe and the United Kingdom and America, in order to work with religious leaders, political leaders, and say, what rules of the road are we going to put on this new technology? And they've come up with certain guidelines. First of all, we should probably start with very simple genetic problems like sickle cell anemia, Tay-Sachs, cystic fibrosis, muscular dystrophy. These are very simple. We know which gene is causing the problem, which gene is mistaken. One letter out of 3 billion mistake, you get sickle cell anemia. So it's already been used to cure somebody of sickle cell. It's been used to cure congenital blindness. It's been used, as I say, in both China and in Pennsylvania and in Philadelphia for cancer therapies that are in clinical trials. Then I think we should say, what about more complex genetic things like height or eye color or hair color? Those are pretty much determined by our genes, but it's not a single gene that does it. We have to be more careful because if you're messing up with a lot of genes, you know, you could have some unintended consequences. But within a decade or so, we'll be able to do it safely and accurately. Then you get into the much more complicated things like intelligence or personality or schizophrenia or depression, things that have some genetic dispositions, but are a mix of genes and environment and many other factors. And those are things I would not mess with for a long time. I think we're a few decades away from that. I also would focus on things that are disabilities, real problems like sickle cell, as opposed to enhancements, which is, you know, just like you could cure sickle cell, you could also make our blood cells have more oxygen. And so you could turn your kid into a runner or a marathoner. But I think we should do it when it's focusing on a disease or disability, not when we want to enhance kids.
Yeah. So there's a host of things to unpack in what you just talked about. And one of them is that it's easy to see how this kind of technology can increase the gap between the haves and the have-nots, right? Because I would imagine that gene editing could be a very expensive process, and not everyone can afford to edit their children and sort of design them to their specifications.
And that's especially true when it comes to a line that I didn't just mention, but that's even further harder to cross, which is inheritable gene edits. When you do it in sperm and egg and early stage embryo, reproductive cells, and that means it'll affect not only the newborn, but all their descendants, all their children. And that's already been done in China by a rogue scientist who edited the early stage embryos of what became twin girls to edit out the receptors for HIV, the virus that causes AIDS. So as you say, once you get into that realm of making inheritable edits, which by the way, we've already seen happen, that's when you get to a problem of, should we allow the rich to buy better genes for their children? That gets us into the Brave New World scenario where there's a genetic elite, or the movie Gattaca. And I obviously think that that's something we really should try to prevent. And if we just leave it up to individual choice, where anybody could go and have a shopping list at a genetic supermarket, so to speak, when they're at a fertility clinic, then people are, if they can afford it, going to choose better genes for their kids. So that's one of the moral, I think, challenges we have to guard against.
And there's also, you know, the technology getting into the wrong hands or getting into too many hands. You write about Josiah Zahner, I believe his name is, and he comes across in the book as sort of a shock jock of bioscience, if you will. And he wants to make CRISPR available to the public. He sells some of this kind of technology. And I guess the question is, can biohackers ultimately be useful to the science of gene editing, or more harmful?
Well, during the digital revolution, it was the hackers that pushed the thing forward. As Steve Jobs said, you know, the people who are crazy enough to think they could change the world are the ones who do. And so you had places like the Homebrew Computer Club, which Bill Gates and Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak hung around at. And it's what it sounded like. It's, let's take this technology from the big corporations and let's use it in our garages and let's power, you know, computer power to the people. Well, Josiah Zahner, who pops up in my book a few times, almost like Puck in A Midsummer Night's Dream, to sort of say, what fools these mortals be? They're wringing their hands. Let me just show you, we're going to do it. So I do think there's something useful of citizen scientists who are getting hands-on experience, but I think we have to guard against people in their garages making genetic edits. Fortunately, CRISPR is easy to do. Even I could edit human cells in a lab, but I flush mine down the drain with chlorine. The difficult thing to do is to deliver them into the human body. So I don't think we're going to have biohackers in their garage doing CRISPR dangerous things anytime soon.
And then, of course, there are various governments and the ways in which governments might be able to use this technology. We were talking before we went on the air about, you know, the possibility of constructing soldiers that don't feel pain and that sort of thing. Talk about that if you would.
Well, Putin has already mentioned that. Putin said that to a youth conference, that we'll use CRISPR to have soldiers that are resistant to radiation or don't feel pain or don't feel fear, he said. So that's something to think about. Yeah. The Defense Department funds a lot of research, including on anti-CRISPR, which is what it sounds like. It's a way to stop a CRISPR edit or turn it off or change it. So I think we have to look at that. But I think we'll also have international discussions and treaties. It's already been Jennifer and a lot of people are part of this group trying to say, with China, who's being cooperative. The Chinese scientist who made those inheritable edits was arrested and is now in jail because it violated Chinese policy. So I do think we'll have to try to enlist international cooperation.
Yeah. You know, the decision-making process around all of that as it relates to gene editing is a highly nuanced thing, you know, and you point out in the book that it's one thing to say, well, it's great if it, you know, heals disease, if it cures diseases, but it's not so great if we can design our own kids. But as you write, it's much more nuanced than that. Can you talk about some of the complicated questions that arise around, you know, these decisions, you know, when we talk about editing our genes and also who makes the decision about whether and how we do that?
You know, we could leave it to individual choice, which is our instinct, but that, of course, does lead us to a world in which people buy better genes for their kids. And I think we want to stop that. I also think that I have a lot of, you know, case studies. There's no easy answers in these things, but there are a lot of smart people dealing with it. One of whom I'll mention is a kid named David Sanchez. He loves playing basketball. He's 17, but except for when he doubles over in pain in the middle of the court because he's got sickle cell. And they tell him at Stanford where he's being treated, we may be able to edit your reproductive cells at some point so your children won't have sickle cell. And his first reaction is, well, that's great. That would be wonderful. And then on second thought, he says, but maybe that should be up to the kid after the kid is born. And yes, why? And he says, well, sickle cell taught me character. It forged who I am. It taught me empathy. It taught me resilience and getting up off the floor. And so maybe we shouldn't edit that out. And then I thought, well, that's pretty wise, but that's amazing that he would think that. And a few months later, I asked him and he said, well, I've thought about it more and I don't want my kids to have sickle cell. I would have it edited. And I said, well, what about the empathy? And he said, well, I'd try to teach them empathy. And I use that example as something where, you know, we have first thoughts, second thoughts, third thoughts. But let me emphasize here, because we've been talking a little bit about, oh, the Russians may do it and this is bad and it could lead to this. This is a godsend for our species. This is great. And there'll be 20% of the things we have to, or things we have to worry about. But when I'm doing these talks, or when Jennifer Doudna goes out and does these talks, I'm always getting, I get now 7 or 8 per day of people who email me or send me messages and say, here's a picture of my 12-year-old grandson, or here's my 15-year-old daughter. And they send me pictures and they say, and he has, you know, muscular dystrophy, or she has a rare genetic condition. Can you get me in touch with Jennifer Doudna? They say she's going to die in 3 years. So these are the type of things we're going to be able to do. And this is why this is a wondrous, wonderful technology that's helping us fight coronavirus, cancer, but also these, there are about 7,000 genetic conditions and diseases that are simple, that involve single genes or so, and they're deadly and horrible. And this will help us fight those.
Has COVID changed the conversation at all around gene editing? Has it made it any less controversial? Has it made people more open to the idea?
It's made me more open. It's made Jennifer Doudna more open. The Chinese scientist who's in jail did so when he made the edit so that the twin girls would not have the receptor for HIV, the virus that causes AIDS. Everybody was shocked and thought that was horrible, and he's put in jail. But after a year of coronavirus, I'm thinking, all right, if we could safely and easily do it without unintended consequences and make our species less susceptible to viruses, I'm open to that. I mean, every creature on this planet, large and small, uses every trick in their playbook to help them survive and thrive and their children thrive. And we have the right to do so as well. It's natural. That is natural for species to do that. And so we have to make sure it's safe. We have to make sure it's equitable. We have to make sure everybody has access to it. We have to make sure there's not unintended consequences. And that's going to take a while. But we should keep pushing because, yes, we're going to want to make ourselves less susceptible to viruses, less susceptible to cancer, less prey to Tay-Sachs and sickle cell and Huntington's.
So you mentioned the Chinese scientist and the twins who he edited to become resistant to HIV. Just as an aside, what do we know about those children and sort of where they are now? And are they, in fact, resistant to HIV?
Well, they're only two and a half years old. And we don't know a lot about them. They're being monitored by the Chinese. But, you know, he's in jail and they have parents who had HIV. And I think we'll get the scientific studies in a couple of years.
Yeah. You mentioned that you are able to do some gene editing. You had an opportunity to try your hand at it, as it were. Can you tell us about what you did?
Yeah, it was pretty simple. I worked in Jennifer Doudna's lab with a couple of great graduate students. I have pictures in my book of Gavin Knott and Jenny Hamilton and all. And it's something you do in test tubes with pipettes. It's solutions. It's not like you're sitting there with a scalpel or an electron microscope. You're just taking CRISPR solutions and putting them with human cells and deciding what properties you're going to edit. In the case of the human cell I edited, it was a kidney cell, and I edited in a little phosphorescent recorder molecule so that it would glow in the dark. So I could see if it had gotten edited, and then we mix it with chlorine and flush it down the drain. So this is not a complicated tool to use. And what makes it particularly powerful and useful is you can reprogram it. You can say, okay, I want to edit in this fluorescent gene. I want to take out, I want to change this letter in, you know, a T to an A so the person doesn't have sickle cell. I want to take out this Huntington's disease sequence. And now with things like base editing, we can do letter by letter. And with prime editing, we can do huge chunks of DNA. We can do multiple genes at the same time. And these are just technologies that have happened in the past year and a half, 2 years. So this is moving very rapidly.
You also had an opportunity to be part of the vaccine trial some time ago. Tell us about that experience. What made you decide to volunteer to be part of that?
Well, as you know, I think RNA is a wonderful molecule. I've been studying it. Jennifer had been turning me on to how it began life on this planet. And then I guess last June or July, we started hearing about the clinical trials for Pfizer and Moderna, which, as we said earlier, is using RNA simply as a messenger to say, build this spike protein so the patient will have immunity or the recipient will have immunity to coronaviruses. And my biohacker, Josiah Zahner, you mentioned, said, hey, I concocted in my lab and I've shot myself up with this vaccine that can do that. And he sent me a vial of it and said, you do it too. And, you know, even though I can sort of smile and admire Josiah for doing these things, I'm not going to take some homebrewed vaccine and take a needle and put it myself. But I went out here in New Orleans to Ochsner Hospital, where they were doing the clinical trials. I signed up in the end of July, and it was one of the first people to go through the trials. First, I got a placebo, and then they switched me over to the real thing, and they monitor it. It's something we all should do, by the way. And the University of Pennsylvania has some of the greatest medical research in the world. And if you're interested in helping science, you actually should go to the website. Just type in clinical trials. And no, it's not dangerous. I mean, it's my wife was worried about me doing because I had to drive all the way out Jefferson Highway to get to the Ochsner clinic. She thought it was more dangerous me driving there than getting the vaccine. So I think these clinical trials are very safe. And all of us, just as we participate in everything from jury duty to voting to cheering our football teams on, we should also participate in science. And this is a very useful way people can participate.
Yeah. Can you talk a bit about your creative process? I was struck as I read the book by how many, many, many people you interviewed for this, also kind of getting your arms around the science of it with Jennifer and her team. What does it take to put together a book like this?
Well, I love talking to people, and I think I have a talent of making them want to talk. And I just old-fashioned. I door knock, you know, meaning I'll go meet somebody. I'll call them up. I'll come to their lab. So I spent weeks in Jennifer Doudna's lab. I went to the rival in her book, the one who's in the great race to use CRISPR in humans, Feng Zhang at MIT, and, you know, spent time in his lab, had lunch with him at, you know, Seafood Chops. We went to Quebec together for CRISPR meetings and different things. So, and I spent time in Berlin with Emmanuel Charpentier, the French partner that Jennifer has. They're all charming people. And so I think we have to, as journalists, as writers, as reporters, and you know this because you're in the field, we just have to make sure we stick with the basics, which is calling people up, talking to them, listening, learning, not having some preconception of what you're going to do or gotcha game you're going to play, but just say, tell me about it. And I ask very simple questions, which is, tell me about it, as opposed to, you know, trying to weave a narrative before I got the facts.
Yeah. Well, before we go to questions from our audience, I will ask you the question that's been floating around for a lot of us, and that is, what are you most looking forward to post-pandemic?
Well, I hate to say it, but down here in New Orleans, we're kind of post-pandemic. I've been vaccinated for a few months, and we go out to dinner all the time. The city's open. It probably shouldn't be as open as it is. We did shut down for Mardi Gras, but I like being with people. And even through the pandemic, I tried to be safe and wore a mask and socially distance, but I always found it was very important to have dinner with friends. And Now we're doing it, you know, closer, and we're doing it in larger groups. But I, despite all these Zoom meetings we're on and our ability to work remotely, I think we're a social animal and we really need to be around other people. Yeah. I mean, I was hoping to come to Philadelphia and do this in person, but I guess it's not quite ready yet.
Well, by the time the next book comes out, we'll be able to
meet up. It'll be my seventh appearance at the Free Library. Wow.
Well, that will give us all something to look forward to. We're a little jealous here in Pennsylvania because we're not quite as far along yet, but we're getting there.
We probably shouldn't be either, but we're cautious. And it's pretty low rates down here. So we get to go out to dinner at least.
That's something we all miss up here. Well, let's go to our audience questions. We'll start with one from Carolyn, who says, the curiosity that you've seen in your subjects, have you noticed any trends across your subjects in terms of how it was cultivated in them?
Yes, they were curious about everything. Leonardo da Vinci, of course, most famously of all, loved everything from art to anatomy to math to music to zoology. But even Steve Jobs and certainly Ben Franklin and definitely Jennifer Doudna have a basic curiosity, not a purpose-driven curiosity, but just a pure curiosity, like why are these repeated sequences in these bacteria? Or why is the sky blue? That's something in Leonardo's notebook and Einstein's notebook. Why do the seashells swirl the way they do? Jennifer wondered about that. Einstein wondered. Ben Franklin famously wonders about swirls of water and swirls of air and the Gulf Stream. And of course, Leonardo does. So it's just curiosity for its own sake, basic curiosity. One of Leonardo's sort of scribbles in his notebooks was describe the tongue of a woodpecker. Now, who wakes up in the morning and says, I need to know what a tongue of, I mean, how would you even, you have to get a woodpecker, open it? No, Leonardo wanted to know. And so it's that passionate, playful, obsessive curiosity. And by the way, we all had that when we were in our wonder years before grown-ups started saying, stop asking so many questions. So it's a type of trait we can all nurture in ourselves again if we wanted to.
Yeah. Question from Anna, who says, in order to use CRISPR to cut a gene, doesn't one have to know that that's actually the gene involved? Not many diseases are that clear cut, and one has to distinguish between constitutional DNA and somatic DNA, which is not inherited by genes that affect just the muscles or the blood cells.
Right. Well, first of all, in around the year 2000, when we finished the Human Genome Project, and then subsequently sort of map the genes on the 3 billion pairs of letters in our DNA, we got a pretty good idea of where all of our genes are and which sequence does which things. And with CRISPR, it's easy, and RNA, it's easy to turn off a gene and test. All right, what does that gene do? And you're right, it's much easier to make the edits when it's a simple genetic, you know, situation, like sickle cell, as I said, is really just one letter out of that 3 billion gets switched. So there are enough diseases to deal with right now that are simple genetic diseases. It gets more complex when you, you know, move up the ladder to things like height or hair color or eye color. Those are pretty much determined by a certain set of genes, but a few more. Then you get to very complicated things like, you know, intelligence or schizophrenia or depression, which are mixtures of genes and environment and chance and other factors. And we certainly don't know how to do those yet. And when you talk, you use the word somatic in that question, that means cells in the body, as opposed to reproductive cells that will go down through all generations. And those are ones, for example, you can do that with sickle cell, because those, it's blood. And so you just take out the stem cells and bone marrow transplant, and you can make the edits and put them back in. And that's how you know you're getting to the blood cell. Likewise, we're already doing it for blindness because eye cells, you know, we know how to get into them. But there are other cells that are much harder to reach.
Question here from Jason, who says, it seems inevitable that this technology will also be applied to other species. Can you talk about how other animals might have their genes edited, both our food stock and, heaven help us, our pets?
Yeah. Well, it's already happened. First of all, a lot of agriculture now uses gene editing. In fact, The progress in gene editing was largely done early on at Danisco, which is a cheese and yogurt company, a multinational, and it's got billions of dollars at stake with its bacteria starter cultures. So two scientists there discovered exactly how CRISPR helps these bacteria fight off viruses. And it was patented by Danisco. So every time you eat yogurt or cheese, you're eating something made from bacteria that you had CRISPR to fight off viruses. It's also been used in agriculture. And when you talk about in animals, in experimental ways, we've made cattle with double muscling. It's pretty simple to change the gene that regulates muscle growth. We call it myostatin. You can even do it in humans. And this is something we're going to do at some point. And parents are going to want, or athletic directors are going to want stronger kids, and they're going to do it. But we've made already cows with double muscling and frogs. And one of the people in my book, one of the biohackers, David Ishii, has done it with pets, since that was the question, made a Dalmatian that glows in the dark using those phosphorescent things that I told you I edited with. Yeah. Why you would want to have a Dalmatian that glows in the dark, I don't know. It seems actually kind of cruel to me, although he turned it off pretty quickly after he did it. But yes, we will have pets and livestock and someday children that we edit some of the traits for. But I hope we draw the line at the children and don't do it until we really know what we're doing and do it very sparingly.
Well, a question from Laszlo that sort of picks up on that, which says, the possibilities you describe are terrifying. It reminds me of Icarus. Might we not fly too close to the sun and crash and burn? And who will regulate the possibilities?
Yeah, as we're going to talk about Greek myth, it's more like, to me, Prometheus, because we're snatching fire from the gods, fire that perhaps, we're not ready to use properly. I do think it's terrifying, but let me say one more time, because I'll forward you all these emails I get. I know people who have suffered from cancer, people who have suffered from muscular dystrophy, who are dying because they have cerebral palsy or things like that. This is a great technology. And yes, we have to try to make sure that 20, 30 years from now, rich people aren't designing babies with special attributes. But we shouldn't be afraid of science so much that we just say, this is horrible, this is scary, let's shut it down. People suffer from really bad genetic problems and from cancers that are really bad and from Alzheimer's and from things that can have genetic determinants. And eventually, I'm not even against editing again to prevent receptors for certain viruses. And if we could lessen the pain of schizophrenia or a bipolar disease, we as a species probably should do that. So let's not focus on we're being Prometheus or we're being Icarus and we're going to flame out. Let's try to use it wisely and go step by step, hand in hand. It's a slippery slope, but that means we have to do it carefully, step by step, and not rush it, but do it carefully.
So you mentioned Alzheimer's a moment ago, and Jane asks, what about dementia/Alzheimer's? Are they amenable to this technology?
Yeah, it's not something that's been done yet, but certainly memory cells and memory is something that can be genetically enhanced. Alzheimer's, as some of you who may have had to deal with it in your family know, is a disease we really don't understand. I think we're barking up the wrong tree sometimes as we look at some of the purported causes. But there is clearly a genetic component to it. And now we're looking at ways to modify the genes that seem to predispose people to Alzheimer's. But it's not just Alzheimer's. We can do things with memory. Now, I don't think we want to improve our memories too much. One of the joys of my life is I tend to forget a lot of things that have happened, so I'm kind of happy. I don't remember people who may have written a bad review of the book or something. But, I do think the ability to genetically enhance neural networks and neural receptors is something we will have. And we should focus on using that against dementia and Alzheimer's rather than in trying to enhance super brains.
Yeah. A couple of questions about Jennifer Doudna, who we talked about at the very beginning of the interview. Michael says, you mentioned briefly about the reaction that Jennifer's high school counselor had to her going into science. Can you talk about the challenges she faced throughout her career as a woman in science? And there was another question, yes, from Sissy, saying, can you go into the sexism that Doudna faced and how it may have determined her course as a scientist? So I'll let you take both of those questions.
As I said, she ends up not being part of the boys' club that's doing DNA, but this happens to be a big advantage. She becomes part of a group which has many women in it, Jillian Banfield, Emmanuel Charpentier, that are focusing on RNA, which turns out to be the place on the soccer field you wanted to run to. It was the right place to be. And by the time she discovers the structure of RNA and is racing to figure out how to turn it into a tool to edit genes, I don't think she would say she faced a lot of sexism. I mean, everybody was trying to be part of her team and part of her lab. And nowadays, the sexism in the life sciences is receding. 60% of people studying biology in graduate school or undergraduate are female or women. So women are not underrepresented in the field. Now, minorities are, African-Americans are definitely underrepresented in the field. And that's really bad because it's our species, our life we're talking about. Where Jennifer faced sexism and real headwinds was, and some of your people and patrons here would nod very well and understand it, was when it came to the venture capital community. When she decided she wanted to start a CRISPR company, now called Mammoth, and another one called Caribou. And she'd go to venture capitalists, and they tended to talk to the men in the room who had been the scientists. And when she started companies, they'd suggest a few men who might run the company for her. And when she looked around the room of all the bankers and finance people, they were almost, or she says, in some cases, all male. And I think that women in the biotech world and the biosciences don't have a bad problem now at the bench, meaning at lab benches. They're at least 50, 60% of the people at the bench are female. They do have a problem when they get to the business world and want to start companies and be taken serious as biotech entrepreneurs.
Yeah. As a follow-up to that, Barbara asks, most of us need wiser people around us to mentor and encourage us, especially when we aren't getting answers that satisfy our curiosity right away. Do your subjects have mentors, or are they so far advanced in their thinking that they are out on their own? And if so, how do they keep themselves motivated? What makes these explorers and pioneers keep ticking?
Well, Jennifer had a wonderful and still does mentor named Jack Szostak, professor at Harvard, who was very young when Jennifer was even younger and became a graduate student under him. He's the one who said, ask the big questions. And when she says, what are the big questions? He said, how did life begin? And he's the one who pushed her to look at RNA because he was starting to look at it. He wins a Nobel Prize for the research that Jennifer's helping him do. A Nobel Prize, before that, he won the Nobel Prize for RNA and how it was the origins of life on this planet. When Jennifer won the Nobel Prize in October of this past year, there was a celebration, mainly on Zoom. And I was there, of course, and Mark Zuckerberg, who helped fund some of the Jennifer's work, was there. And so was Jack Szostak, and he gave the final toast. And he said, the only thing in life better than winning a Nobel Prize is having your student win one of them. Mm-hmm. And so he's always been a mentor to Jennifer. And Jennifer has been an absolutely great mentor, mainly for women. I mean, a lot of times for women, but men as well. And when you go around her lab and you look on the benches of the people doing experiments, she has mentored some really great women. And the leaders of her company, despite what some of the venture capitalists wanted, are Janice Chen, Rachel Horowitz. They tend to be women leaders of the company she founds.
Yeah. Pranav asks, what is the paradigm where digital technology is converging with biosciences? Is there something in the next decade where we will see CRISPR converge with physiological data? For example, we have companies that manufacture specific drugs/vaccines based on monitoring our vitals over the years.
Excellent question. And of course, that is the future. There are people like Cameron Myhrvold, who are in my book. His father, Nathan Myhrvold, some of you may remember, was the number two, the chief technology officer at the old Microsoft in the early days. Well, Nathan inherited his father's love of digital coding, but he became a geneticist and focusing on genetic code. And he's combining the two in a field that's called computational biology. And he has helped lead the way in using CRISPR as a detection technology, not only for COVID, the coronavirus that causes COVID, but for all sorts of viruses and to find ways to chop them up. And he does it, and so do many other people, including those in Jennifer's lab, by going through computationally huge numbers of sequences of DNA and trying things out on computers. So the future will belong, you know, I made sure, you know, my daughter, she loved computer science. She knows how to code, but I assume her children will have to learn how to code genetically as well. Not necessarily have to do the four letters of the genetic code, but have to have some feel for what we do with genes. And it'll be people who combine the digital revolution with the life sciences revolution that will be in the vanguard of innovation.
A couple of questions about cancer here. Helen asks, what type of cancer is UPenn working on? And there was another question from Vivian who says, about how close are we to developing reliable anti-immune compounds to fight specific cancers? And which cancers do you think will this therapy address first?
Yes, I don't want to go too far in describing what Penn is doing because I'm not fully sure of what's the latest. But what it focuses on is the immunotherapy and personalized immunotherapy, which means use our own immune system to kill the cancer cells. And what you can do now, of course, is sequence the tumor that you're looking for, use CRISPR to find and early detect any evidence of that sequence, because that's what CRISPR does. It finds sequences of genetic code, but then also use that to create the proteins using messenger RNA, but the immunotherapies that will be tailored personally to the tumor that you're afflicted with.
Wow.
What it does is also make sure that tumor can't fight back. So it's really personalized immunotherapy geared to your specific cancer that's at the forefront of this. And when that sort of answers or dodges the question of which types of cancers, because it really goes to any tumor, especially things like pancreatic cancer, that's so hard because you don't get it early enough and it's spreading to different organs. And that's when you have to use immunotherapy to fight it. But I do hope the free library will have somebody from the University of Pennsylvania at some point, because it really has done great work there.
A question from Georg, who says, you pointed out the impact the life science revolution will have on humankind. What specific fields are you personally most excited about besides CRISPR? And what should upcoming scientists and entrepreneurs focus on to contribute to this revolution? What are the skills needed in this biology-focused revolution?
I'll give one example that I think will be big in the next year or two. Jennifer's working on it, her competitors at the Broad Institute are working on it, which is using RNA and these technologies we've discussed for detection, because that's an important thing. It may not be as sexy as some of the other things, but if you can detect exactly what's happening really early on, that's going to be important, especially when it comes to coronavirus. And so they have developed, and we'll see in the next few months, home testing kits for coronavirus, cartridges. Put a little saliva in, put it in the cartridge. It's like a pregnancy test. You can buy it at CVS, let's say, take it home, and it's a little appliance that sits in your home somewhere, your bathroom or your kitchen. And why I'm excited about that is, first of all, if we could all test every morning for COVID, it would be a real good way to stop the new variants, and we'd be able to detect the new variants and we'd stop the spread. But once you can do that, you can also test, all right, my kid has a sore throat. Let me see if it's strep throat, and there'll be cartridges for that. Let me see if I've got my wife. We just came back from somewhere and she has little things on, you know, she got bug bites and they seem to be infected. And so she went to the doctor to say, all right, is this a bacterial infection? Well, these home devices will be able to say, yes, that's a bacterial infection, or no, that's just some swelling. You'll be able to, it'll be like an app where, like a phone where people can build apps. So somebody might say, let me have a test for your gut biome, microbiome, see if you're eating the right yogurt to make sure you have the right stuff in your microbiome. Let me see if that cancer tumor has come back or any other cancer tumors. And so once you have this little biology detection device in your home, and every day you can test for things, that's going to bring biology figuratively and literally into our lives, into our homes. And people will be developing apps just like they develop apps for the iPhone. And we didn't know what apps would be developed for the iPhone. I never dreamed that I'd be taking an Uber tonight once this is over to go somewhere, or that my friends would be at an Airbnb. But people will be able to build on these home molecular detection kits to say, all right, I want to know how much sleep I should be getting, anything like that. I think that's exciting.
Question from Matt, who says, if we do see a biotech revolution over the next 50 years, as you've suggested, will gene editing be the foundational technology like the internet was to the information revolution? Or are there adjacent technologies and developments that you think will play a big role?
That's a great question. I think, and the reason I focus a bit on gene editing, although we get to vaccines and many other things in my book, is gene editing is very easy to understand, and it is a big deal. Like, okay, you know, I want this gene that'll give me more muscle mass or make my, you know, blood carry more oxygen, whatever it may be. So I think it's the most visible thing that we'll be doing. Having said that, certainly vaccines using mRNA or cancer treatments using messenger RNA or being able to fight diseases, because the way to fight them sometimes is either they're making a bad protein in our system or they're preventing a good protein from being made. So we could take this technology and say, have your cells make these proteins, just like we're having my cells make the spike protein to give me immunity for coronavirus. So genetic engineering in general, and for that matter, using molecules and programming them to make proteins that we might want, all of that will be part of the genetic revolution. And some will probably be as important or more important than editing genes. It's just that editing genes is the one that we really have to wrestle with morally more than the others.
So Ellen asks, please describe the difference in the process between writing a book like this, in which the main characters are all alive, versus your book on Leonardo da Vinci, in which the main character died centuries ago.
Yeah, I mean, it's actually so much more thrilling to be doing somebody who's alive, especially, weirdly enough, during coronavirus. After I'd spent 3 or 4 or 5 years reporting it, then when we're all socially distanced, I can be in every Zoom meeting and lurking in every Slack channel and reading every Google Doc as it's being written. And so the book is sort of, I hope, is told as if it's a real-time narrative, as if we're going through this detective hunt, you know, in real time. So you just know a whole lot more. And it actually plays a bit to my strengths, which, as I said, is I'm just good at knocking on. I mean, I'm not that shy. I'll knock on somebody's door and say, let me just sit in your lab for a few weeks and do it. So I like writing about people who are alive, but it's just using a different set of muscles when you say, all right, I'm going to do Leonardo da Vinci based on reading all of his notebooks.
Yeah. Well, I think Carolyn has given us an excellent question to end on, because I think this is a question that all of us are curious about. And that is, what's the subject of your next book?
I promise you, I don't know. I think we went on vacation this past week. I just got back thinking of a lot of things. There are three or four people in the current climate that are interesting. Bill Gates in so many different fields is brilliant. Jeff Bezos has changed our world a lot, but we're still in the middle of that story. Elon Musk reminds me of Steve Jobs, but once again, I think we still have to see what the final reel of the movie is, although that's such an old metaphor. I'll have to come up with a better one, because most people don't know what a movie reel is. And then there are people in history I'd look at, but I truly, I'm not playing coy here. We're still juggling this one.
Well, we will have to stay tuned, but in the meantime, we'll be able to enjoy The Codebreaker, Jennifer Doudna, Gene Editing, and the Future of the Human Race. Walter Isaacson, it has been an absolute honor to speak with you this evening. Thank you so much for being with us and sharing this incredible knowledge with us.
Tracy, you're a wonderful interviewer, and I really appreciate your good questions. And those of the audience, wow, that was a great set of questions, wasn't it?
It was indeed. Many thanks to all of you who have participated and contributed such great questions to our conversation. We want to thank, of course, Morris Williams for introducing us and kicking off the whole evening. And of course, Andy and Laura and Jason from the author events team at the Free Library of Philadelphia, who keep it all together. Thanks to all of you for being with us. Be safe out there. Be careful. And we hope to see you next time. Have a good night, everybody.
Good night. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.